freedom is precisely what must be destroyed if this is to be turned into a fundamentally different country to suit Obama's vision of the country and of himself.
Look, folks, there comes a time when it's time to stop fiddling while America burns.
That's right. Woo!
If we lose freedom here, there's no place to escape to. This is the last stand on earth.
And every time they mess with it, they make it worse.
What they are trying to do is create an America very unlike the America that has existed for centuries.
And regardless of their sincerity, their humanitarian motives, the trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
This is KLZ, Freedom 560, with your host, Ken Clark.
You know, you're welcome to say anything you want about the administration, past and previous administrations, and the reasons why we may or may not be going into war. Say what you will. Have the debate. That's great. Fine. I'm all game with that. But don't you ever, and I mean ever, disrespect those men and women who wear that uniform. We have been at war in this country over and over again. Sometimes, like right now, it seems like we're in a state of perpetual war. But there was something that did happen in our history that I think is in a true tragedy. During the Vietnam era, this country unfortunately turned its back on its men and women that donned that uniform. They didn't have any say as to why this country was going into war. They just did their duty and they went and they defended the United States of America, and they did it with honor. And when they came home, unfortunately, they were not treated well. That's very unique. For the first time in our history, that was the first time we did disrespect the men and women in uniform. Fortunately, that has changed. I think America has gotten it now. I think we understand the sacrifice our men and women in uniform, the price they pay. I think that that has changed, and I am ever, ever so grateful for that very simple fact. But let's not forget that the men and women who fought in the Vietnam era war were not treated with the same kind of respect. Well, I've got a Vietnam veteran who is joining me on the air right now, Bob Dubeck. First and foremost, sir, let me say thank you for your service and welcome home.
Well, thank you very much, Ken. And I want to also thank you for the opportunity to be on your show today. And you are correct indeed that when the Vietnam veterans returned, they did not return to a welcoming country.
No, they didn't. In fact, they were treated as criminals themselves, and I think it is a huge black eye in this country's history. However, things have changed, and you, sir, you had a lot to do with that, and I want to talk about that because you've got a brand new book that was just released on July 1st, and it talks about creating the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. So, talk about that. Let's please.
Well, yes, this. I was in charge of building the Vietnam Veterans Memorial on the Mall. Actually, the book, I don't mean to correct you, but the book was actually released last Thursday on whatever it was, July or June 18th, I believe.
Okay.
And it was earlier than we expected. And I served in Vietnam in 1969 as an Air Force intelligence officer. And although my tour itself wasn't dangerous, I did see a lot of the war. I saw a lot of people. I saw a lot of death. And when I came back, I went to law school here at Georgetown University, and I became a lawyer in 1974. I wasn't really too thrilled with that profession, and I thought maybe I could help other Vietnam veterans because I heard a lot of guys were having problems. And I went to a meeting in 1979, and there a young man stood up and said, well, what about having a memorial? And strangely enough, most veterans at the meeting put him down. They said, we don't need a memorial, we need more benefits. But I really thought that the idea was a sound one, that really what everybody needed was a pat on the back. And that young man was named Jan Scruggs, and he had served in Vietnam as an infantryman and been wounded and hospitalized, seen half his company killed or wounded, and came back and got a bachelor's degree and master's degree and did a thesis on the psychosocial readjustment of Vietnam veterans, which which basically concluded that because they had not returned to a supportive societal atmosphere, many were having their problems readjusting, and that a memorial would serve to provide a measure of recognition. Should I go on, or would you like to?
No, I am fascinated by this, and I want you have the floor, my friend. You have the floor, because I do want people to understand. And you're right. I mean, that was a different time, and unfortunately, we treated the people that were coming back from that, from their service, from their tours of duty, as criminals themselves. And I think the memorial, I have seen the memorial. I have friends that were Vietnam veterans. One's got two Purple Hearts. The other one has one. Those are two very, very close friends of mine. And so I know how they were treated. I saw the damage that was done. And I think the memorial did a huge amount of service to those men and women in honoring them, because they didn't have any part in the politics. They were called by their country, and they went.
That's correct. That's correct. And and so here we were. And I had experience as a lawyer with setting up nonprofit organizations. And so I suggested to Jan Scruggs that he form a nonprofit organization, and we would make it tax exempt under the Internal Revenue Code, so people could make contributions and deduct them from their income tax. So we had, we started off, they're really just no money, a tax-exempt organization, and gradually the idea built. We attracted another guy after about 2 months. We attracted another guy named John Wheeler, who was a West Point graduate, very brilliant man. He was West Point graduate, he had a law degree, he had a master MBA from Harvard University, and he had worked on building the Southeast Asia Memorial at West Point. So he had and he also had very good contacts among professionals around Washington, especially a number of attorneys who were Vietnam veterans. So we began having regular meetings and began putting together a program and began... And I mean, all of this is pretty much detailed in my book. But of course, to create a memorial, we had to create an organization from scratch. We had to worry about everything: accounting. We had to worry about public relations, fundraising, getting a design, construction. But fortunately, we had good people who had knowledge in various areas, and people joined in and contributed. And pretty soon, and actually after about 9 months, we decided we needed a full-time staff. So I became the first, I quit practicing law and became the first full-time staff member. And we grew from there. But I think the thing that made the memorial most memorable is the design we chose. And we chose it through an open national competition, because we were getting so much interest from artists and designers and sculptors across the country that I felt that there had to be some objective way that we could make a choice, some way that we could, hold people at a distance and put up a filter that could filter through all these varying competing ideas. So we decided to hold a national open competition that would be open to any U.S. citizen over 18 years of age. And we had a number of criteria for the design. We felt the design, first of all, could not make a political statement about the war, because we felt that the argument about the war itself is what had denied the veterans their due recognition. And secondly, we felt that the memorial is for all veterans, but we wanted to pay a special tribute to those who didn't return. So it bear the name of everybody who was either missing in prisoner status or killed in action. And then, of course, we wanted to have it in a beautiful setting on the mall. We felt that with so much rancor about the war, we wanted to have a quiet garden. So we got 2 acres of land that are right between the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument. And so we said that the memorial design would have to be compatible with the environment. And finally, we said the theme of it would be reflective and contemplative in character. I mean, it would not it would not throw an opinion in your face. It would be a place where people could come and reflect upon the sacrifice and the service made. And so that we had 14, we picked a blue ribbon jury of most famous designers in the country to judge it. And we had actually 1,421 entrants. So we had to, there were so many that we had to get an aircraft hangar at Andrews Air Force Base to hang them all up to be seen by the jury. But the jury chose, the design that was chosen by, was authored by a 21-year-old woman who was still an undergraduate at Yale University. Her name was Maya Ying Lin. And she was born in America, but her parents were immigrants, were refugees from communist China. And they were both professors, academic professors of art at a college in Ohio. So, you know, it was a sort of a complex adventure. We had to, she wasn't a professional architect, so we had to enlist a professional architecture firm. We got Gilbane Building Company, the same company that had built the Air and Space Museum. Of course, it turns out in building the memorial, the biggest problem was actually getting all the names inscribed, 58,000 names inscribed correctly on those black granite walls.
Bob,
and, why don't you interrupt me? Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to, we need to go to a break real quick. And when we come back, I want to continue this conversation because I think this is fascinating. I don't think anybody really truly understands what it took and what went on behind the scenes to put together this dedication to the Vietnam veterans. But I do want to continue that. And so when we come back, let's start there. How did we get the names on there? We'll be right back right after this. And I am back. This is Freedom 560, and I am pleased and honored to have on the air with me right now Bob Dubeck. He is the man behind the Vietnam Memorial. He was the pilot, the driver. He was one of those that made it all happen. And if you've ever seen it, it is a very powerful thing. I have seen it in person. They sometimes will take some parts of it or replicas of it on tour and tour the United States of America, and I've seen that as well. And I have some very dear friends that are Vietnam veterans themselves. And so, Bob, it is an honor and a privilege to have you back on the air with me again. And so let's talk about this some more. You were talking about one of the biggest challenges. Well, first take a step back because and go through real quickly and recap the process, the judges, and how many entries you had for the design of it. Real quick, start there.
Well, we did a national competition open to any American 18 years of age. You didn't have to be a professional. You could be an amateur. We got 1,421 designs. We had a jury of the top, the most famous designers in the country. There were three sculptors, two landscape architects, two architects, and the editor of a magazine. And they took a week and sifted through all of the designs. They looked at all 1,421, came up with a design that was authored by a student who was 22 years old, or not yet 22 years old, a senior at Yale University, a woman who was born in the U.S. of Chinese-born parents who fled China after to flee the communists. So basically, you know, there are many challenges. A lot of it, we hired Gilbane Building Company, the same company that built the Air and Space Museum, so we had tremendous expertise behind us. But the thing that was really a challenge was to come up with inscribing 58,000 names into granite, into the granite panels on the wall. And when we first, the designer's original intention, of course, she was an experienced architect, she thought we could inscribe them all by hand. Early on, we got an estimate that that would take every available craftsman in the world, take 10 years or 3 years and $10 million. So we couldn't do that. And so obviously we were going to have to make a stencil and sandblast. But the problem with stencils is that they have to be cut and there's chance for error. But, you know, this thing often reminds me of the biblical story of the fish and the loaves, because very often when we needed something, it came to us unexpectedly. And I got a phone call from a young man in Cleveland, Ohio, and he said, well, he's sort of a, pardon me, nerdy guy, which is a positive thing nowadays. It wasn't back 30 years ago. And he said, I think I've invented a process that will help you inscribe all those names. And what this guy had done is invented a chemical emulsion that was painted on the surface of the granite. And when it was exposed to, and it while, well, until it was exposed to light, it was water soluble. Afterward, it was no longer water soluble. So we will take all the names on a clear piece of plastic with the names inscribed in black, put them down on the panel, expose it to light, wash it with water, and we would have an instant stencil on the face of the panel. I know this is hard to understand. I have it explained in detail in my book. But that's how we were able to do it. And by doing, putting that, you know, putting his process into production for the first time, we were able to inscribe all those names in over a three-month period in Memphis, Tennessee. So that was a remarkable part about the memorial. I personally, in order to make sure the list was correct, I went through it and proofread the list eight times myself. And, of course, you know, you find about all the different variances. And there's so many different national groups and ethnic groups in America. We have so many prefixed names, and they caused a particular problem in getting the prefix names, getting the prefixes in there, so the computer wouldn't read them as middle names or last names. And then, of course, there were the names of men from the South, where the people are named Billy Bob or Danny Jean. And generally, we put people's name up on the wall with the first name, middle initial, and last name. But, you know, I found out it wasn't correct. You don't put Billy Bob up as Billy B, because Billy Bob is not a first and a middle name. It's a compound first name. So there were many things like that. Now, I know we don't have much time, and, of course, I have to mention the fact that there was tremendous controversy over the design that was chosen, because it did not dictate a message. It was, you might say, contemplative in character. There's some people who perceived it, and because it was black and it receded into the earth, there's some people who perceived it as a negative message that we are trying to impart, that we're ashamed of the Vietnam veterans. I mean, as if we would go to the trouble to build this memorial to express shame to ourselves. I mean, it didn't make sense, but a lot of people felt that way. So as somewhat of a political compromise, we decided to add the statue of the three servicemen to the wall, which resolved the political controversy, and I think in the end result probably makes a better product for everyone.
Yeah, and there, you know, there was controversy swirling around everything that had to do with Vietnam, and so that doesn't surprise me. And today, you can't step outside on your sidewalk, take a deep breath without causing somebody somewhere some sort of controversy. I mean,
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, and it's ridiculous today. But that being said, I think that that was a fair compromise. I've seen the picture, or I've seen the statues themselves, because I have been there. I have seen it. And I think it is a remarkable achievement. But real quick, in the time we've got, about, I don't know, 4, maybe 3 minutes left, but talk about what it was like to get through the bureaucracy of D.C., because I know that this was launched and dedicated in 1982. So hopefully things weren't quite that bad back then.
Well, they were a challenge. I mean, we had to get the approval of three commissions. We had to get the approval of the Fine Arts Commission. We had to get the approval of the Planning Commission. And then we had to get the approval of the National Park Service. Now, in this case, the Planning Commission and the really the Park Service and the Planning Commission and the Commission of Fine Arts really were positive about the design of the walls. But we had Secretary James G. Watt, and he basically, his constituents, who probably like your listeners, are on the conservative bent, and many of them were the people who thought the thing was, you know, a negative statement. So he was very obstinate, and it took a very long political process in order for him to finally sign off and let us break ground for the memorial, and then to finally let us locate the statue where it is now. So that was really the that was really the main challenge, is dealing with the Secretary of Interior himself.
Well, James Watt is originally from Wyoming. He was a friend of my dad's, and I've thrown back more than my share of whiskey with that guy. So, yeah, I get where you're coming from.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really do. All right.
Can I put in a plug here?
No, you bet. Please, please.
Yes, if anyone wants to order my book, it's available through McFarland Publishers. The 800 number is 253-2187. And the book is called Creating the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, The Inside Story. And my name is spelled D-O-U-B-E-K.
D-O-U-B-E-K,
Yeah, Delta O-U Beta E-K.
Very good. Bob, I want to thank you for joining me today. That is a very powerful story, and I'm looking forward to your book, and I'm going to try to get it as soon as I can and read it. I'm sure it'll be out on a Kindle edition as well, too, right?
I hope so.
Now, do you have a website dedicated to that book, too?
I don't have a website dedicated to the book. That's a good idea, but there's a web site for the publisher. It's mcfarlandpub.com. That's M-C-F-A-R-L-A-N-D. PUB.com, McFarland Pub.
Well, and I've heard stories about people who are veterans themselves who go to that wall looking for a friend, and for some reason they're able to walk up to it and just find them immediately. And there are lots of neat stories like that out there.
They call it wall magic.
Yeah. Yeah. Bob, I cannot thank you enough. Bob Dubeck, and thank you for joining me today. And thank you for all you have done in creating the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
Thank you very much, Ken.
All right.
I hope you have a good day.
I will. I will, sir. Thank you. And you just made my day. So thanks so much for joining me on Freedom 560. When I come back, I'm going to dive into two things. First and foremost, I am going to hit what's going on with Uber. And then after that, I'm going to talk about the Fast Track Trade Authority, because here it comes again. Thank you, Republicans, for selling out the United States of America once again. We'll be right back. Clark, I am your host. This is Freedom 560 on KLZ 560. If you'd like to join me, 303-477-5600. Now, I want to talk about Uber. I'm going to blast through this in just this segment, because if you remember correctly, and I believe it was the 2013 legislative session, there were a bunch of us, not me particularly, but there were a bunch of legislators that needed to pass a law in order to make it legal for Uber to operate in the state of Colorado. Senator Marble, Representative Sane, Representative Everett, a whole slew of them had decided that, yes, we are free market capitalists. That's what we do. And if Uber wants to set up shop in Colorado, why can't they? Well, the taxi companies had such a stranglehold on the bureaucrats that it was very difficult it was impossible for Uber to open up shop in Colorado. So the legislators, the members of the assembly got together and decided this was wrong. So they passed legislation in order to do that. And I fought very, very hard on the air to make sure that legislation would, in fact, be passed. And it was. So Uber now operates here in Colorado. And I'm very, very happy about that. Now, Uber's a private company. They are a private company, and as such, they have the right to handle their business any way they so choose. I want to make sure that I make that statement very clear. They are a private company. They may decide how they want to operate that company, and it's not up to me or anybody else to dictate to them what they do and don't do with their internal policies. However, I am a consumer, and I am up until today, I used Uber all the time. I'm not going to use them anymore, and here's why. They have decided to have a policy that says no guns allowed. An Uber application is shown as cars drive by. This is coming from 9news.com. On June 10th, The company updated its legal policy to prohibit the possession of firearms in vehicles being used for its service. The ban is for anyone inside an Uber vehicle, including drivers and passengers. Those who fail to comply with the new policy risk losing access to Uber services. Okay, they changed their rules following two incidents where Uber drivers fired their guns. An Uber spokesperson released the following statement. We have adopted a no firearms policy to ensure that both riders. Yeah, really? Another gun-free zone? Are you kidding? That's going to matter somehow? Anyway, let me finish this. We have adopted a no-firearms policy to ensure that both riders and drivers feel safe, because after all, feeling safe is much more important than actually being safe. As long as you feel safe, whatever. Reminds me of those idiots that are on the radio going, you know, it's okay to give up a little bit of your freedom in order to make sure that we're protected from terrorists. And so therefore the Patriot Act was a great thing. These guys are brain dead. Oh, well, anyway, that both riders and drivers feel safe and are comfortable on the platform. We made this policy change after assessing existing policies and careful reviewing recent feedback from both riders and drivers' partners. Now, again, they are a private company. They are welcome to make those policy decisions as they choose. Now, the drivers now have the right to decide whether or not they want to continue being a driver for Uber. It's a free market. They can decide whether or not they want to stay on board with that or not. I, as a consumer, have a right to decide whether or not I want to use Uber. Now, for those of you that have listened to Freedom 560 for any length of time, you know I never go anywhere without a sidearm. Ever. Right now, at this very moment, I'm packing. Okay? That's just the way it is. I do not leave home without one. I don't believe any woman on the planet should leave home without a sidearm. That's just because it is good common sense. With that gun comes tremendous amount of responsibility, which I take very seriously, as do all gun owners that I know. As do all gun owners that I know. Okay, but that being said, I now have a decision to make. Am I going to use Uber or not? Well, the answer is pure and simple. No, I'm sorry. I'm just not going to. Now, here's something that I think is a neat little caveat to this whole story. This came from Breitbart. This was earlier today. Uber bans guns after driver uses one to stop attempted mass shooting. Uber bans guns. Okay, I just read that. On June 19th, Uber announced that it banned both drivers and law-abiding passengers with concealed carry permits from having guns for their self-defense while under Uber vehicles. This comes 3 months after an Uber driver with a concealed carry license thwarted an attempted mass shooting by pulling his own weapon and shooting a gunman who had opened fire in Chicago's Logan Square. Why is it that over and over and over again, we see these psychopaths that are these lone gunmen who would commit these heinous crimes, they go to gun-free zones and open fire? We have that very scenario that's in court right now here in Colorado with the theater, the Aurora Theater shooter. That was a gun-free zone. He drove past several different theaters to get to the one that did not allow concealed carry on its premises. Why? Well, obviously, the guy didn't want to get shot. So he chose to go to a place where he knew nobody was going to shoot back at him. That was a gun-free zone. So while I do disagree completely with Uber's decision, I think it's insanity. They are a private company. They have the right to do it. And that, I believe, in first and foremost. But will I ever use Uber again? No, I'm sorry. I won't. And I love the service. I fought hard to get that business allowed in the state of Colorado because I was sick to death of the cab companies dictating who couldn't do business in Denver, in the state of Colorado. It was mafia style tactics that they were using. I mean, they had a complete and total stranglehold on the industry. Uber was a free market solution to that and a great solution. I love the app. I'm very disappointed in the decision they've made. And I think they are making people more vulnerable to attack as a result of that policy. There is only one way to stop a bad guy with a gun, and that is a good guy with a gun. Not to be outdone, and this goes to, I'm going to be bouncing around a little bit, Karl Rove, okay, today he has announced violence will continue until the Second Amendment is repealed. Karl Rove said that. So what happened to the backbone of our Republicans? What happened to standing up and standing for principle? Uber is just the latest casualty in this. I mean, God forbid you go to a Chipotle. I mean, God, they're going to give you, or is it Starbucks or Chipotle, Randy? I can't remember which one that likes to make the political statements when they hand you your coffee or your soda. I mean, I can't, maybe it's both. I can't remember. I think it was Starbucks, yeah. But Chipotle always likes to get involved with this as well. They have gun-free zone strapped all over they have signs on all their stores, so I don't eat at Chipotle. I didn't think they were that good anyway, so it's been no loss to me. But you've got Karl Rove. Karl Rove, who is supposed to be the architect of the Republican wins. You know this is the guy that's going to be the driving force behind Jeb Bush. Karl Rove says that gun violence is going to continue until we get rid of all guns. You want to see some real gun violence? Come try to take Patriots' guns from them. Seems to me that happened back in 1776. Didn't turn out so well for the British. It really didn't. I wonder if history will repeat itself. Who knows? Maybe it will. But during this happened yesterday. Breitbart just posted this today as far as Karl Rove is concerned. During the Sunday airing of Fox News Sunday, host Chris Wallace asked Karl Rove how America can stop violent attacks like the one that the country just witnessed in Charleston. Rove said, acts of violence will continue until someone can force America to repeal the Second Amendment. Wow. Wow. If that is not a huge statement on the Republican Party today, I mean, if that just doesn't say it all, I mean, that one statement, I think, speaks volumes to the state of the Republican Party today. That's why we're getting Mitt Romney's. That's why we're getting Jeb Bush's. That's why we're getting John McCain, Bob Dole's. Randy, I know you wanted to chime in on this.
My head's just about to explode.
Yeah, this is one of those times where all the voices in my head are telling me to go home and clean my guns.
Well, I think the Republican Party, I mean, if Karl Rove fancies himself some sort of leader in the party, the party's done if he's making statements like that. What's next, a First Amendment? That one not good enough for you either?
I guess. I don't know. The first, second, and fourth under serious assault right now. I mean, they really are. And I am very disappointed in Uber's decision, but that is the decision that they've made. Okay, well, as I said before, I'm a free market capitalist. I believe that this is a private company. They have the right. They do have the right to make this decision. Okay, that doesn't mean that I'm going to use their services anymore.
No.
Because as a consumer, don't I have that right, Randy?
And I'm not going to drink Fat Tire beer anymore either.
Well, then you
different reasons.
But. You thought it tasted like the bottom of a fraternity after a kegger party. So
the morning after taste.
God, that brings back memories. I do not. Yeah, and we all know what that smells like too.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I appreciate that. But you know what? Uber can do what they want. I'm very disappointed, but I won't go to a movie theater that's a gun-free zone. I won't eat at a restaurant that's a gun-free zone. I will not go into a store that has got one of those gun things on their sign. And if you really want to know how to know where these businesses are, there are a couple apps out there that will show you what they are. One of them is Second Vote, okay? Second Vote is an app you can download on your Android or your iPhone, and it'll tell you what businesses throw money where as far as their charities are concerned. That's a very, very good one. There's another one that I believe is just simply called Gun Free Zones. I've got it on my iPhone, but I can't seem to find it right now. And but you can go there and see what businesses allow guns and what businesses don't.
So do they have any recourse at all? If they catch you with a gun, in their store or in their car or whatever. You know, we declare our store to be a gun-free zone. You can't carry a gun in here. Hey, look, you're wearing a gun. Can they call the police and have you escorted out? What can they do about that?
They can call the police and have you escorted out. And in fact, there was an incident that happened a few years ago where a law-abiding concealed carry permit holder was inside of a store. They called the police because he bent over to pick something up and somebody saw it. She then went to management. That turned into an incident. That guy ended up getting shot. So you need to be very careful because, and he did not handle it well. He did not handle it well. But the app is, in fact, called Gun Free Zone. I did just find it on my iPhone, and I have it on my iPhone. It's called Gun Free Zone. Go to your app store, download it. It's free, and you can use it. Okay, and I'm sure they update quite often, so you can find out whether or not the store and the people that you are giving your money to, the products and services that you are buying, whether or not they support the Second Amendment. I think that's a very powerful tool. I'm really bummed about Uber. I mean, we've got the Western Conservative Summit coming up, and I had every intention of using Uber to get back and forth to that. Now I'm not gonna. I'm close enough to walk, you know, and now that it's not, there's no snow on the ground and summer has finally hit, I will probably be walking to and from the Western Conservative Summit, or I might take a taxi cab, but I'm sure as hell not going to take an Uber. I'm just not. And that's my decision. It's my money. I'll spend it the way I choose to. Can't tell you. We fought so hard to get Uber able to do business in the state of Colorado. This is a big, big disappointment and a letdown. Now, when are we going to go to break? When we come back, I'm going to fill you in on what's going on with the TPP in the Senate, because I'm wondering whether or not Mitch McConnell, our fearless coward, I mean, wait. Is he? I can't call him our fearless leader. Our fearful leader. He's probably going to join the ranks of Paul Ryan and John Boehner and cave on Fast Track Trade Authority. Gotta tell you, Randy, you're knocking it out of the park with that music today. I'm digging the bumper music. Welcome back. This is Freedom 560. I'm your host, Ken Clark. In the last segment, I was talking about concealed carry permits and Uber. And we have Doug from Boulder who wanted to chime in on that. So, Doug, welcome to Freedom 560. What have you got for me?
Oh, I was just wondering about the libraries. I'm just now at Lafayette Public Library, and they have a sign out there that says no weapons are allowed inside.
Okay, and I think that is a colossal mistake because you're opening up that library to be a gun-free zone, which means the people that are in that library will not have the opportunity to defend themselves should some madman decide that that's what he wants to do today. Now, here's the thing, Doug. You've got that sign. Now, you think that sign makes you safer?
No.
No, of course not. And these guys are killing people. Last time I checked, murder was already against the law. You think they're going to care about one more stupid law out there? You think they're going to care about that sign? You think this guy that walked into that movie theater decided, wow, there's a no guns allowed sign. I'm not going to go kill a whole bunch of people today.
Well, I just wondered about libraries. I just didn't know. I never thought about it until I was walking into this one, and I don't see the sign right now. And after I brought this up, I'm standing out by the door, but I don't see it right now. But I know it was there.
Well, maybe they took it down. And, you know, you've got all these municipalities that always say you can't carry a gun inside a municipality. Really? Like, that's somehow going to make a difference. Now, with the state capitol down here, okay, they do have guards on the entrances, and they have metal detectors. So that at least provides some semblance of security. However, somebody that was trying to skirt that, they're going to find a way to skirt that. But you know, they don't have that at libraries. They don't have security guards. They don't have metal detectors. So everybody in there is a sitting duck. Doug, I'll give you the last word.
Oh, well, I was just seeing what you would think about that. That's all.
Well, I think that's a total mistake, and I think it's stupid, and that's what I think. I think they're creating a shooting gallery. If someone were to choose and be demented enough to go do that, they're just creating yet another shooting gallery. Doug, thank you for calling into Freedom 560. I really appreciate that. So let's talk about this. As early as tomorrow, the Senate may be taking up the cloture vote on the Fast Track Trade Authority. I mean, they were able to, under the let's see, they did some very interesting shenanigans last week in the House of Representatives, and I'm talking about the Fast Track Trade Authority. I'm talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And what Paul Ryan did was he took a bill that had already been passed, gutted it, and then threw inside of it the Fast Track Trade Authority. And that's what they did. That's exactly how they passed Obamacare. And if you remember correctly, we railed on Nancy Pelosi for doing that. And we railed on Harry Reid for doing that because it's a fraud. It's a fraud perpetrated on the American people. That's exactly what Paul Ryan did. Well, now it is up at the Senate, okay? So now we've got to stop this thing in the Senate. So this is basically what's happening, and we need them to vote. Tomorrow, the Senate may be voting on cloture, and what that means is a close of the debate. They will take it to the floor. That means also that we've got some quote-unquote Republicans that will be caving on this thing and willing to pass it. Also, what it means is that Harry Reid, who still controls the Senate, make no mistake, Mitch McConnell doesn't, as much as he loves to puff out his chest and make everybody believe that he's now the president of the Senate. He's not. It's still Harry Reid. Okay. If they vote for cloture, that means that they're going to be voting on the TPP. Now, Cory Gardner has already voted for this thing once. They have to do it again because this was passed in such a fashion that it does not reflect what was done already in the Senate. But if you want to call out Senator Cory Gardner, right now would be the time. We already know that Michael Bennett is bought and paid for. I think it cost $53,000 to flip his vote on Fast Track Trade Authority. That's what he was paid. That's what he was paid. Now, he's got a Senate run coming up, so he needs every penny. Cory doesn't. He's just your basic, typical sellout. So I would still call him, tell him what you think. But Bennett's already been bought and paid for. We know that. If anybody out there, if you are a philanthropist, if you are someone who has big, big, deep pockets, please write a massive check with a promise for future funding to Michael Bennett. Maybe you can buy his vote if you're the highest bidder. I would ask that if you, please do that. I'm begging you. I don't have the ability. I don't have the money to do that myself. So I'm begging and hoping that somebody out there with very, very deep pockets will buy off Michael Bennett because he's obviously for sale. He's obviously for sale. I think we know that, right, Randy? I mean, we know that. That's what it took to get him to flip his vote, $53,000. Can't remember if it was 53 or 56, but 50-something thousand dollars.
Our next contestant on The Price is Right.
That's exactly right. But, I mean, they are doing this, and they are twisting arms. Obama wants this thing so badly. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I don't need to go through. I don't have time to go through all that legislation anymore. But, man, oh, man, let me tell you, it's not good for the United States of America. There's a reason why the labor groups and the unions, the labor unions, are fighting mad trying to stop this legislation and this trade agreement from happening. The reason is simple. NAFTA and every other quote-unquote free trade agreement that's been passed in the last few years, we have a caller that calls into to KLZ all the time and brings us up to speed on all this stuff. This is a guy that knows a lot about what he's talking about. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. Every single time we do a quote-unquote free trade agreement, it destroys more and more of the middle class of the United States. It hurts the workers. It hurts the people that are out there just trying to make a living. It shoves jobs overseas. It makes it harder for us to compete. We have got the highest tax rate of any industrialized country in the entire world. Why don't you knock that down to zero? Why don't you knock that down to 15% maybe? Make it at least competitive to the world market. Then you'll see companies want to do business here. This Trans-Pacific Partnership is not it. We have a very short window of opportunity. You need to be calling your congressman. You need to be, not your congressman, your senators. Call your senators now. Call them. Tell them to vote no. Tell them to kill this thing before it's too late. I'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned. You're going to have Chris Cook tonight at 6. I think, who's filling in? Dan Maurer. That ought to be fun. Till then, have a great afternoon.